three information. The first 2 days are going to be devoted to post-structuralism and deconstruction. The following day, we're going to probably start with the literary work. In this case, Dylan Thomas's poem. So my objective is not to cover Dylan Thomas's poem in this class, nor in the next one. At the beginning of the third one, we'll transition from evaluating Dylan Thomas's poem to covering the following units. In the case of the study guide, you have critical essays. These critical essays are fundamental for understanding the unit. I don't deal very well with computers. No, you don't. Let me see. Marta. Which copy of the book did you have? Which edition of the book do you have? The third. It's on page 321. You have the poem is on is an appendix to the book. So you have it on page 321 of the third edition, and you have it on page 345 of the fourth edition. Okay, so after during the contents of chapter 3, we're going to see some of the content. No, you can download the poem from different sources. I mean, it's a poem in the public domain, so you can download it from I think poetry.org, for example, has that poem. That's the copy that I normally read from, because it's just more convenient than flipping through the pages of the book. But if you have, if you want to only use one book, you have it on page 321. You will see that Dylan Thomas's poem is very obscure and difficult to understand. What is my recommendation? Read the download study guide today. If not today, tomorrow. Okay? Start reading everything, especially, and I'm going to even change the color, the critical essays. Okay? Read chapter 3 of Peter Berry's book, but in the same order that the study guide is telling you. Okay? The study guide is going to give you the specific order and specific instructions, and that's how you should read the chapter. Okay, read Dylan Thomas's poem. Bring all that knowledge to the next class, so we can deal with it and we can see the type of difficulties that you're running into. And if you have the opportunity, watch the video class, which will give you many more tools to confront Dylan Thomas's poem. Remember that Unit 1 and Unit 2. Are the source for the prueba de evaluación continua. This prueba de evaluación continua accounts for 20% of your final mark, and the contents are Unit 1 and Unit 2. What are the difficulties of Unit 3 and Unit 4? That you have to read 2 full novels. Yes, you do. Very sorry to say so. I don't know if you were aware of that, but for Unit 2, you have Elizabeth Bishop's poetry. You have some of that poetry also in Unit 3. We'll get there when we get to that river. We'll cross that bridge. So for the moment, we're not going to worry about that. What I need to ask you to do is, I don't know how many classes we have before Christmas and how many we have after. Let me check that for a moment. We have only 2 classes after Christmas, so I'm going to leave the majority of the work that has to do with reading the novels for after Christmas. I'm going to start with The Awakening the first of the books that you have to read, The Awakening by Kate Chopin, and that basically is going to help us understand the contents of Unit 3. You can basically buy any edition. The better the edition is, the more the prefaces and the critical work will help you. But you can even download this from the internet. It's in the public domain. So if you have a Kindle, for example, my main obsession is for you to read it, Celia. If you're going to read it, if you have it in a Kindle edition, I really don't care if you bought the most expensive one or the cheapest one. Most of the work that you have to do has little to do with the quality of the edition that you buy and has more to do with how much you've worked with the text, okay, and how much you've been able to dissect the text. As you can see, mine has a lot of marks that I use for the analysis. Not in the public domain yet, I think, Heart of Darkness. I'm not very sure if Heart of Darkness is in the public domain. If it is, well, it's if it's not, in any case, it's one of the cheaper books that you can buy. You have it in Penguin Classics. These are normally under 10 euros in at FNAC or Casa Libro or Amazon or wherever you decide to buy it. The original text is from 1899, so of course it's also in the public domain. If you have a Kindle, you can go to, let me tell you, or a Kindle or a Kobo or whatever e-reader you have, or on your iPad. If you go to Gutenberg.org, you can download both books in ebook format. So that would be an EPUB or a Kindle format, whatever the case. And if you want to listen to the book at the same time as you read it, which is something that is normally very interesting for gaining a bigger amount of information on a first read, I normally use the website LibriVox.org, where they upload free audiobooks of classic books. The Awakening is one of the books that is there for sure. And I think that Heart of Darkness is also there, but I'm not very sure. But just check it. They have all the major books, so there's no reason why these books shouldn't be there. So even though it's me again, on the study guide, I can only find the literary text. What do you mean the literary text? Introduction to Critical and Literary Theory and Critical Authors. So I'm again lost trying to find those critical essays you said were so important. Well, at first, in unit number one, I understood what you said. If you download the study guide for unit one, I'm going to quickly do that. So I can follow you. So this is if I'm reading from the study guide, because I mean from year to year I forget about the details. So in the beginning it says the literary text is Dylan Thomas's text. That's what I said. You have it as an appendix in Barry's Beginning Theory. I'm reading from the study guide, page number 2. Introduction to Critical and Literary Theory, that's chapter 3. And the critical authors are the critical essays that I was talking about. So what I was talking about is the critical authors that are mentioned in the study guide. And that is, in this unit, two very, very important names that you have to start to consider household names, like Roland Barthes and Jacques Derrida. Roland Barthes and Jacques Derrida have to be the new Lionel Messi or, I don't know, Chicotes of your life. They're very important figures, and you have to be absolutely familiar with their work to the extent of what is included in this study guide. So basically what you get is you're lucky. I had to read the entire essay, The Death of an Author, which is an interesting read, but it's very long. This information you have on page, this is page 5, I would say. Page 5 and 6 of the study guide for Unit 1. And Derrida's work is on page 7 of the study guide. There you have some questions. You should be able to more or less address those questions, but that's what we're going to deal with in class, okay? So my job is for you to understand those essays, those critical essays, once you've read them at least once, okay? So Death of an Author and of Grammatology. These are the critical essays. Death of an Author. Death of the Author or of an Author? I would say the Author. Death of the Author. Yes, of course. It wouldn't make sense. Death of the Author and of Grammatology. Okay. Is that clear now, Marta? Are we okay with what we need to know for this unit? As you can see, it's a lot of bits and pieces, and that's one of the difficult things about this unit. We're going to have to download a study guide, maybe print it out, as Marta was saying she had done. Read a chapter from a book, which is not the first chapter. It's a third chapter. Read a poem. Try to make sense of that poem. Go back, watch a video class. Try to make sense of that video class. Connect it to Dylan Thomas's poem. And units 1 and 2 are supposed to be the easy units, because units 3 and 4, for units 3, you have to have read The Awakening. And for unit 4, you have to have read The Heart of Darkness. So that's what makes this unit, this subject, so demanding, that it takes many hours out of your life. You need to devote a lot of time to a subject that seems to be much heftier than only a semester, a one semester subject. And I can agree perfectly well with any of you that says, my God, this should be a yearly subject. They should probably boost it a bit more and make it a yearly subject. There used to be a third book, just so you can understand how complex this subject is. My recommendation, read The Awakening first. I'm going to deal with The Awakening first. I'm going to deal with The Awakening, in fact, if my planning doesn't blow up in my face. My intention is to deal with The Awakening in the classes of December the 14th and January the 11th. And I'm going to deal with Heart of Darkness in the classes of January the 11th and January the 18th. Why do I leave them to the very end, to the very last three classes? To give you time to read them and understand them. You should start with The Awakening right away, because it's not very long, but it's a longish book. And it's a very nice book also. So I think that you're going to enjoy it very much. It's going to make the entire subject more agreeable and easier to digest after the initial impact of the complexity of the first and the second units. Okay, so The Awakening, my recommendation, start to read it, but we won't deal with it until mid-December to give you all the time in the world to get through it. I will talk about it, however, when we get to Unit 3. If I follow my own planning, today and next week, 19th and 26th of October, I'll deal with Unit 1. I'll deal with Unit 2 on the 9th and on the 9th of November, and on part of the 16th of November. I'll deal with Unit 3 during part of the 16th and the 23rd. And on the 23rd, I'll start Unit 4, and I'll finish it on the 30th of November. That's a theory. Afterwards, reality can place us in a different scenario. But in case you miss any classes, that way you know the kind of pace that you have to follow. Okay? One class and a half per unit. This first unit is going to take us two classes because of all this initial explanation, just so you feel more confident about the subject and you don't freak out from the very first day, as I did when I was a student. Okay, so I hope that all of this introductory stuff was useful for you. Now, for the rest of the class, we're going to focus on the first unit that has to do with post-structuralism and what comes before post-structuralism and why post-structuralism is so important to understand for understanding literature. Just a quick check. Can you hear me correctly? Is the connection stable? Is everybody on the same page? Great. Thank you very much, Sylvia. Great. Thanks a lot. Okay, so before I read about excellent. Before I read about post-structuralism from the book, and I'm always going to address where I am in the book so you can read at the same time as I'm reading, I'm going to fall back one unit, and I'm going to read from unit two. You don't have to follow, but if you were interested, this is on page 38 of the third edition, and in the fourth edition, this is on page 40. Okay, so I'm going to read bits and pieces of structuralism. What came before post-structuralism, and why do we start at that point with a post-structuralism? Let me open the presentation on another device so I can see what's the next slide in each moment. Just give me a quick second to get through that. In the meantime, wait. Okay, we're going to talk about what comes before structuralism. And on page 39, what it talks about is how does this concept or this profession of critical theory shape itself? Critical theory starts. We can trace it back to probably the Romantic period. For example, in American literature, every writer that was significant, like, for example, let's say Nathaniel Hawthorne or Edgar Allan Poe or Herman Melville, they had a dual position. They were writers. They were pioneers of fictional writing. But they were also critics of the writings of the rest of the authors of the time. Because, as a matter of fact, there weren't many writers and there weren't many people, in fact, that read. So from the beginning, there was a sort of bias about explaining how to analyze a work from the point of view of whether it had sufficient literary quality and whether it should be called a universal work or a non-universal work. The idea of universalism is really interesting. So can anybody write in the chat, if I say universal literature, what works comes to mind? Hamlet, Don Quixote, the works of Chaucer, the Beat Generation, Romantics, Realism, Flaubert, so many hundreds and thousands of works have been labeled with that universal work of art, that over time, after Romanticism, over the turn of the century, when we were starting to get into the 20th century, there started to be people that had a point of view that was like the authoritative point of view of what was universal literature. So, Liada, yes, that's a very good case. In fact, that you're mentioning. Let me see if I can get your name, Marta. What you're saying, Marta, is really interesting because why should we include Greek works or the Roman works of Seneca as part of our literature when it's a literature of a different era, of a different period of humanity? Should it be considered at the same, to have the same stature as other types of literature? And that's where there are bases. Okay, that's a really interesting point of view. The basis for who? You want to say something like they're a foundational cornerstone, no? The work of a critic turns into creating these cornerstones of literature, and they say this one yes, this one no, this one yes, this one no. This receives in literature. This receives a name. It's called a canon. A canon is all the books that you should read before you die and appreciate and love and know that they're universally good. El Quijote, it's because you're a bad reader. It's not because Don Quijote, Las Aventuras de Don Quijote de la Mancha is not a good book. Or that's what was said until that moment. What is behind all of this, in fact, is the idea of universal. And this idea of universal was created by liberal humanism. And this liberal humanism created a concept of a foundational cornerstone of literary gem. We can call that literary gem as a key concept that was normally in consonance with a patriarchal society. What does a patriarchal society mean? A society where men and women marry. The role of a man is to get a job and provide for their family. The role of a woman is to take care of the family and be a good wife and be loving and ensure that the next generations take place. So this is the patriarchal society. The other aspect is Eurocentric. It's extremely Eurocentric. What makes a work of art universal? And Marta fell into the trap that I was placing for her absolutely. Sorry about that, Marta. There was a trick in that, in making you say La Iliada or talking about the works of Shakespeare or whatever other work you would come up with. It's only based on what happens in this white European culture and everything that stems from it. So, for example, American literature, it's part of our of the Western idea. So this Eurocentric is, let's say, Western. This patriarchal is basically focused on the man. If you think about how many authors we've talked about that are women, of all those works that we've been mentioning as literary gems, I've mentioned a few. I've mentioned the works of Cervantes. I've mentioned the work of Shakespeare. You've mentioned La Iliada. We would come to the conclusion that barely no works are produced by women. So basically everything that man considers to be important, that belongs to the Western civilization, that is basically white. Because let's face it, we have no idea what type of literature is relevant in the history of Indonesia or China or Namibia. And for the fact, we don't care. We don't care because according to this universal idea that we have, a work of art is only good art if it belongs to this Western society that normally talks about the white experience, from the perspective of white people. And it has some other connotations that also stem from patriarchal. If it's focused on man, it's obviously focusing on a heterosexual reality where everything that isn't heterosexual is kind of weird or deviant or directly not recommendable for us. And look at all those ideas. If we have if we take into consideration, they do, don't they? But do you think they would be considered as some of the great works of art, or they would be considered as exceptionally interesting works by women, as if being a woman was a factor of extra merit? And this is the idea. If you look into the biographies, we're going to learn to look out of the biographies. But if you look into the biographies of Austin and the Bronte sisters in particular, you will see that for them, it was either irrelevant in the case of Jane Austen to write or not write. She wrote for the entertainment of her family, very similar to what Emily Dickinson did. And the Bronte sisters, they wrote against all odds. The most natural thing would be for the Bronte sisters to not have written any of their works because it was so difficult for a woman to be a writer. And this is something that we're going to talk about. Why is it more difficult for a woman to be a writer than for a man to be a writer? And these are all of these elements. If this is universal, by extension, all of these elements have to be part of this universality. Am I right or am I wrong? Does anybody want to contest my idea? Oh, yes. Yeah, not religion. Catholic. And let's say, okay, we're going to put Protestant in the same box and nothing more. I mean, not even Jewish enters this small realm of what is considered universal. Everything that moves left or right from our standard is something that is the other. And the other, it matches with other words like strange, deviant, unknown. We could say mysterious. None of these adjectives have too many positive connotations. Okay, so when we think about what isn't in the universal pattern, we can think that a few women can be part of this list. But if we had to say that men and women have the same right or should have the same amount of works as universal works, we would be going against the canon. We would be going against the tradition, because we've already established that the tradition is for the man to procure and for the woman to take care of the family and to marry well and to maintain her household. It's not a role of women to be writers. So this is what we're going to say. It's not a role for women. It's not a role for a black person. It's not a role for a homosexual person. It's not a role for someone that comes from a colony. These are all the elements that are going to be questioned over the course of time. When are all these elements going to be questioned over the course of time? They're going to be questioned whenever it's possible to question something. So this goes hand in hand with everything that happened after World War II. I think that a very interesting moment in our, not only in our lifetime, but in our history as a civilization happens post World War II. So post World War II, let's say that the state of well-being is so extended that fortunately people can forget about only surviving and can devote their time to thinking about, for example, literature. And the moment people think about literature more and more, they tend to question what has been considered the canon, the set in stone idea of what was universal literature. And people will start to say, why do I have to consider that because someone decided that certain authors were part of the standard, we all have to consider those authors as the universal authors, and I cannot dislike any of these authors, and I cannot like any authors that are not in that canon. Who decides that in such a definite way? So, post-structuralism is going to question authorship. Unit 2 is going to question all the historical elements. Unit 3, feminism, is going to question the patriarchal society. Of course, once we question historicism, universal religion is going to fall as a domino in the same step. And unit 4, racial and post-colonial critical essays are going to question the elements of white superiority, or what can directly be considered supremacism, something that is very relevant nowadays, and gender studies, first through feminism and then through queer theory, are going to question the predominance of heterosexual criticism, and is going to try to refocus works in a different light. So, before I die of a dry throat, give me a second. So, all of these units, at the end of the day, what they're going to do is they're going to question the status quo. And that's one of the ideas that you have to walk away with. It's all about the status quo. The answer to what is good literature? What is universal literature? This is a question that we're going to ask ourselves during the rest of the course. And we're going to realize that there are no correct answers. The problem with destroying well-set ideas, well-established principles, is that you don't always come to a satisfactory resolution that substitutes the pillars of your beliefs. But I think at the end of the day, if you want to truly embrace the idea of what you're studying, English studies, it's very important for you to not take anything for granted, and to not take what is good literature versus what is bad literature for granted is one of the first steps that you have to learn. So from that perspective, is from the only perspective that I defend, that such a difficult subject as this one is taught in the first course and not in the fourth course of your track of studies. I hope that what I've been talking about is a valid introduction and has helped you understand where we're coming from and what we're going to do in this subject. The first thing that I want you to not be afraid of is listening to all those names of authors like K. Chopin, Barth, Derrida, Dylan Thomas, Elizabeth Bishop, so on and so forth, and have the feeling that you're not going to be able to grasp so much complexity. I don't want you to walk away with that feeling. I want you, you to walk away with the feeling that it's a lot, but it's manageable. It's manageable complexity, and it's my job to make that manageable complexity entertaining and productive for you to not only pass the subject, but to understand and learn from the subject and help you start to question yourself. So what is the timeline? We talked about post-World War. Structuralism is a 1950s thing, okay? So this is our preface. This is the preface of what we're going to be talking about today. We talk about post-structuralism. What comes before in the 1950s is structuralism. Structuralism is the first major literary movement or critical school of thought that doesn't accept the idea of universal literature and doesn't accept the idea of a literary canon and one single version of what is good literature and what is bad literature. So from that point of view, it is an interesting intellectual movement. At the beginning of Unit 2, it says, structuralism is an intellectual movement which began in France in the 1950s. So it says intellectual. One of the things that you have to understand is that it's very difficult to constrain literatures to only literature. When we talk about Unit 3, feminism, and you may come to the conclusion of, why are we talking about feminism in a literature course? Because feminism not only is very important in terms of literature, but it stems from literature in a certain manner. All of these ideas in my life are not going to be separate. My political opinions, my cultural opinions, my philosophical opinions, my literary opinions, they're not isolated boxes. They're connected boxes, and they form a whole of my way of thinking about the world, my way of envisioning the world. In that sense, many of these movements don't start as a literary movement. In the case of structuralism, it starts as an intellectual movement, and it's not, it doesn't come from authors. It comes from anthropologists. It comes from linguists. Okay, so from that point of view, it's a different perspective to what I'm used to. In the case of the two most relevant figures of structuralism, one is an anthropologist, Levi Strauss, and the other one is a literary critic, Roland Barthes. And you're going to say, wait a minute. I've already heard that name, Roland Barthes. What are you talking about? So Roland Barthes is one of the key figures of structuralism. And over the course of his life, he travels from structuralism in his early works to post-structuralism. So Roland Barthes is a very key figure of post-structuralism because he is the evolution of structuralism into post-structuralism. What does that mean? If you studied, I don't know how much literature you've studied so far, but I'm guessing that not very much. Right now, the literary period that we're in is called postmodernism. Everything that we read, I don't know, when you read Roth or when you read when you read any of the contemporary writers, all the names that I'm thinking of are post-colonial, which is not exactly the same. They're postmodernist writers. That means that they exceed modernism. They change their what modernism says. So normally a movement that is called post, or any movement that that succeeds another movement, is normally highly critical with the previous movement. You don't start a literary movement or a philosophical movement or any movement of any kind if you don't disagree greatly with the previous existing and mainstream movement. So at the beginning, every movement is at the beginning, every movement is radical. It's underground, and it's a minority. Minority, and over time, movements go from radical to centered. They go from underground to mainstream. And they go from being a minority in the school of thought, if they're successful, to being a majority of the people. Can you all hear me? Because I can see that many of you are leaving the web conference. I don't know if it's a problem with the connection. Okay, great. Okay, yeah, I guess just very late, and some of you have children or other obligations. I understand it perfectly well. Remember that this class is being recorded, so I'm going to post. By the way, where do I post the recordings of the classes? In our forum. Okay, so in the forums, there's a specific forum for our group where you can write to me directly. Everything that you write in that forum, I receive an email, so I get the message faster than if you, or as fast as if you write me an email. But there's an additional advantage that everybody can comment and everybody can see the same message. So it's better for the class dynamic. And I'm going to post the recording of this class in the forum. Okay. So don't worry if in any moment you lose a connection or you didn't catch any parts, you can watch this again if you want. So, structuralism is going to be superseded or evolved or contested or eliminated by post-structuralism. And in the same way, Unit 2, New Historicism, is going to be a critical way of contesting post-structuralism. Not all of them go against one of the previous movements. Many can be against, as we were saying, structuralism was trying to fight against the principles of liberal humanism, which is basically the way that we've always studied literature. Liberal humanism is, I study about literature by reading about the author, finding out about his life, reading the books that they recommend me to read, and connecting things that happen in the book with things that happen in the life of the author. Somebody that's an expert tells me that this book is super good and I have to read it and love it. That's liberal humanism for you in a nutshell. It tells people what to expect and how to expect it, and it gives you one version of the story. Structuralism is like a first approach, a first attempt to break cracks. What each movement tries to do is find cracks in the theory, find cracks in the ideas. So where does structuralism look for the cracks? It looks for the cracks in the language, because structuralism is an intellectual movement. And if I read again from the book, it says, "It is difficult to boil structuralism down to a single bottom line proposition. But if I forced to do so, I would say that its essence is the belief that things cannot be understood in isolation. They have to be seen in the context of the larger structure that they are part of. So I cannot see one book in isolation, because if I see Hamlet normally comes from the books that Shakespeare read and that influenced Shakespeare, and those books at the same time were influenced by other books, by other writers, and so on and so forth. So everything belongs to a bigger structure, and therefore it's a bad idea to set only a few of these works as part of universal literature or universal ideas, because they cannot be isolated. They belong to a bigger structure. I don't know if that is clear. The idea in the next paragraph, it says, the structures in question here are those imposed by our ways of perceiving the world and organizing experience. So let me give you an example. If we think about the city of Numancia, if I'm not mistaken, it's a Carthaginese stronghold that was destroyed by the Romans because they did not want to surrender the city, and it became an example of resistance against the Roman Empire. The story that has reached our time is a story told by Romans about what happened in that city and what happened to the people of that city. But we never get the other side of the story. So from the point of view of saying that the story is stable, it all depends on our perspective. There is a saying that says that history is always told by the winners and never by the losers. So from that point of view, there are always more than one side to every story. So one of the ideas that structuralism works on, and other movements such as post-structuralism and new historicism are going to recycle and reuse, is the idea that the world is experienced in one single way, is experienced and perceived in one single way. And that is not true. Because if we have a look at language, for example, language is something that is unstable. What can be up for me if I'm in the northern hemisphere is actually down for somebody in the southern hemisphere. If I was in a spaceship that had no gravity, I would have no way of establishing an up and a down, a north and south. All of these ideas that I have are subjective. They're inventions of men. And if they're inventions of men and they're subjective, therefore they're not universal. If they're not universal, I can't hold them as universal standards. Those are some of the ideas that are part of the core of structuralism. On page 40 of the third edition, that must be page 42 approximately of the fourth edition, in Signs of the Father, Saussure, it talks about the linguistic structure that meaning is given to words in a subjective way. They're purely arbitrary. Every language gives a way of naming an idea that is arbitrary. Somebody has come up with a way of saying caballo is this animal that you see over there, and if you speak a different language, you call that animal a horse. Okay, so this idea that we give arbitrary ways of defining something is opposed openly with the idea that something in language can be universal, even the works that are created in that language. So if the language is not universal and has no way of finding a universal ground, the works from that language cannot be universal either. And another way is that language has a flaw, that in order to define, if I tell you, can you define caballo to me, you would say, es un animal. Can you define animal? Animal es un ser vivo. Ser, said is whatever you want to say for the definition. You have to use words to define words. So it's not only arbitrary, it's relational. One, words are related to other. Those two ideas, that it's arbitrary and it's relational, is what makes structuralists come to the conclusion that language is the way that we use to interpret our world, but we cannot define anything as universal in our world. Let me see if I can move to the presentation, and we can feed on those ideas, at least before we finish. Very close to the end, but I think it's a very good introduction. Structuralism began in France in the 1950s. As I said, all of these movements are post-World War II. The origins of structuralism can be traced to the linguist Ferdinand de Saussure, anthropologist Claude Levi-Strauss, and literary critic Roland Barthes. As we've seen, Roland Barthes illustrates how post-structuralism becomes a... Barthes makes the transition from structuralism to post-structuralism in one of his works, In Death of an Author. Structuralism is a theory that believes that things cannot be understood in isolation. They have to be seen in the context of larger structures. The structures here are those imposed by our way of perceiving the world and organizing experience. Meaning is an attribute of things. The three principles of linguistic structures defined by Saussure, and this is what I was talking about before, is the meaning we give to words is purely arbitrary. The meanings of words is relational, so no words can be defined in isolation as it needs other words. And language constitutes our world. It does not only record it or label it, meaning it is always attributed or to the object or the idea that we have in our mind, and it's constructed and expressed through language. Okay, so it creates the idea that language seems to be unstable, and using an unstable way of measuring for a stable for something that we're looking as universal is probably not the most the soundest idea or the best idea possible. So what is post-structuralism? Where do we come to the beginning of post-structuralism? The first thing that we have to take into consideration is that post-structuralism is a rebellion against structuralism. Structuralism talks about the language that shapes the world. So how we see the world is what we see, only what we see. And post-structuralism is a point where I'm going to start to ask myself many more questions. I'm going to ask myself, if I can't trust language, I can't trust the works that are created in that language. So therefore, something that I think has one single meaning, and that's where you should go back if you've already read the poem, Dylan Thomas's poem, see if you can find more than one meaning in the words, in the sentences, in the statements that the poem is giving you, and that's where you're going to start to embrace post-structuralism. There's a world of uncertainty, and there is no fixed landmark beyond this reliance on a language that is unstable. I'm going to stop here because I want to devote much more time to talking about post-structuralism, this idea of decentered universe, and the work of the contents of the unit before we continue talking about post-structuralism in the next class. What do I think should be what your work for the week? For this week, I would highly recommend you to read Unit 3 in detail, especially pages, I'm in the third edition. I'm going to take it from both. Give me a second. In the fourth edition, pages 61 to at least So 61 to 67, for sure. You must have read this before the next class. And for those of you that are reading from the previous edition, from the third edition, pages 59 to 65, okay? So that would be for editions 3 and 4. In the second edition, it would be all the way up to the stop and think section, okay? I think that if you're able to read that much, we're going to come to conclusions. We're going to be able to work on the critical essays that we have to work on in the next class, and we're going to start to make relevant. We're going to come to relevant conclusions that are going to help you understand what post-structuralism means, why it's so important as a way of destroying or starting to destroy the idea of universalism that I had, that we had up to that moment, and to start to work in this subject that is fascinating but highly challenging and demanding. So thank you very, very much, and I hope to see you in the next class. It was a pleasure to have you. Thank you very much for participating and for sending your questions in during the class. And that's it for now. I hope it was useful. And I'll post this recorded hour, and add some text to explain some of the things that we talked about before. And if you have any questions, remember the forum is the best way. Okay. Yeah, it's my job, and I love to do it. So thank you very much. You're very kind students. Thanks a lot. Talk to you next week, and we'll be online for at least the classes of October. Maybe in November we go back to the center, but that's yet to be determined. For the moment, have a fantastic week, and I'll see you here next week. Okay, goodbye.